So welcome to week two of this series. Just want to sort of go briefly over some of the things we talked about last week and then continue on to this week. So we're doing nuggets from Viktor Frankl that are taken from one of the books I was showing you last week and YouTube videos and things like that. So last week I just made the point that Viktor Frankl says that he's responding to a decline in society, which is interesting because I think the impact that he had was tremendous, but today we've moved back to that world that he was responding to even more, which is a problem. But we can deal with it. We can bring positivity, right? Okay, we talked about his experiences in the camp and his thesis that he really believes that those people that are, I mean, not people, as I said last week, not people that were killed, but people that were there and needed to push through it. He says when they had a why to live, it was very, very different. And that links into the whole idea of purpose, and we spoke at length about my trip to Israel and how I observed that really there's a very deep sense of purpose there, which is quite amazing. Everyone in a different way, but everyone has a purpose, and just you see it in the whole country. Living in an affluent society makes it more difficult, because it makes it that we fill other needs like pleasure and things like that, or that becomes the default rather than fulfilling the basic need of every human being, which is meaning and purpose, Viktor Frankl explains. And we also explained because living a life of meaning always means giving up something. Again, something you see in Israel tremendously. And when you give up something, sacrifice doesn't have to always be hard. It just means effort. And some people, when we live in a very spoiled society, then we tend not to want to give up anything, and that makes it very hard to live a life of meaning. And he had that beautiful phrase when he said, talked about stress. He says stress is a good thing as long as it's not too much. And he said, he quoted from someone, I forgot the name exactly, and he said, better to be over-demanded than under-demanded, which was a good line. Okay. So, what I want to do today... Yeah.
Yeah.
And we'll get to it later about finding meaning in suffering, and so many of them did that in the most incredible way, which is just mind-boggling. Anyway, so what I want to do today is break it down a little bit more, but also have a look at how Viktor Frankl actually defines meaning. What is meaning, right? And what I'm going to do is I'm going to base it on more of that interview I talked about last week with a guy in Canada in 1977 called Roy Bonister, and also a short YouTube video that I was watching, a different interview, also some concepts about what is meaning. So before we get that, in the interview, Viktor Frankl, he confirms his theory and summarizes it in one sentence. He says the following. He says, a will to meaning, right, the wish to find... That's a key word. You've got to find it first. And fulfill meaning is a basic motivation of human beings, right? And when you have that will, it's not just about living a life of meaning. It's having the will to find meaning, right? Again, going back to Israel, I think that's something you see so much of there because of their circumstance and because of their deep connection to the land and just the whole perspective that they have over there. There's not just finding meaning, there's a will to find meaning. There's an unbelievable desire to find purpose. I was thinking, I didn't speak about this last week, but I'll just interject here for a minute, but the meaning you find there is not just about the war, right? It's not just about because they're under attack and they have to survive, and that's all true, that's part of it. But there's also a very, very deep connection to the land, right? Which is incredible. And it becomes more and more... Especially those people who understand a bit more about the biblical connection to the land and ancestral connection to the land and so on and so forth. It brings that much more motivation for purpose and to protect it and to nurture it. And it's becoming more and more as things are discovered. So I don't think I told you this last week. I've been talking a lot about the trips. I don't know where I say what. But so one of the things we did, we had an unbelievable tour of Ir David. Anyone here has gone to Ir David? Yes. Yeah? And there's someone here, you know, Kevin Burmeister is very involved in Ir David, and he...
It's in Jerusalem.
In Jerusalem, yeah, yeah. Yeah. So, and they keep on discovering new things, which is incredible, right? I'll just tell you a cute little thing, actually. We had a tour. This tour guide was amazing. But one of the things that was amazing about, he was giving us a tour, and he walked around with his Tanakh. And every so often, he'd open the Tanakh very enthusiastically, read a few verses and say, this is it. And this is it, right? We're living Tanakh. We're getting Tanakh, bringing it alive, right? Which is incredible. One of the things, actually, wasn't just Tanakh. It was Mishnah, a lot of fascinating things. I'll just tell you a few because I think it's just amazing. Because I want to bring out this point a little bit, right? So there's a street, which I haven't yet properly opened to the public, but there's the street that was built by Herod, right? Herod, you know, was towards the end of the Second Temple. This is over 2,000 years ago. He was a big builder. Everything by him had to be big and better and everything like that. He was quite an amazing personality. I mean, a crazy personality in a way. But he was an unbelievable builder. He built Masada. He built the building on the cave of Machpelah and Hebron. It was all Herod's building, right? And he also expanded and renovated the temple. And one of the things he did also, he built this road, right? Which, interesting enough, was only discovered, I think, 10, 15 years ago by mistake. Meaning, nothing by mistake. But someone living close to Ir David had a leak. It's a fascinating story. Had a leak. And they couldn't find where the leak was coming from, and they got the water company, I don't know, eventually they had to drill, and they kept drilling until suddenly they dug out the leak. They inadvertently did an archaeological dig, as it were, right? And they found this road, right? With stones 2,000 years ago, more than 2,000 years. And they excavated it, and then the whole thing, they found out a way how to dig underneath all the houses. In Israel, they don't quite follow all the rules like in Australia, or they don't have so many rules, they haven't got time for these petty things. But anyways, they just got it done. And they uncovered this amazing, amazing road, which was built all the way down from the bottom of Ir David, all the way going to the temple, up the hill towards the temple. The reason is because he built it apparently especially for Yom Tov, when all the Jews would come all over Israel. There could be thousands, maybe even millions of people coming to the Beit HaMikdash. And he built this road going up, right? And they found amazing things there. And it just, for me, it was like fascinating, because you have things that I've learned in Yeshiva and I learned in the Talmud many, many times. And when you see it come alive, it's amazing. So I'll just mention two things. So for example, they discovered this platform. It's a road, which is a road. And then there's a stone road. And there's like a sidewalk, like a piece off the road, which they presume was shops, right? There was like shops, and people would sell things. And as, huh?
Stalls,
yeah, that's exactly stalls. That's the word, yeah. And suddenly they discovered this in the middle, like there's this three steps and like a platform. It's all stone. And like it was very odd, right? And they figure, which makes perfect sense, that actually it's because the Talmud says, and if you learn the Mishnah about the mitzvah of returning a lost article. So if you find something, one of the mitzvot in the Torah is you're supposed to return it to the owner, but the owner has to be able to identify it. So there's a whole process called machrizin. You have to announce it. So they used to, it says in the Talmud specifically, that especially during Yom Tov time when everyone came, there was this bima, there was this platform placed in the main street or the main thing, whatever. And someone would go, and if you found the lost article, you found someone's wallet, someone's clothing, some of this, you'd go up and you'd say, I found so-and-so. Someone would say, oh, gosh. And someone, this was like a lost and found sort of thing. Someone who was obviously looking for it would go to this platform. And then they would... So yes, I lost the wallet. So the guy would say, well, you need to give signs, you need to identification marks. And if it was eligible, they would return it. So that's obviously what it was. But you see, like a Mishnah, a piece of the Talmud actually come alive, right? Then what happened was, as they kept digging wider and wider, they found this behind this platform, there was this wall. And then I saw what the wall was doing in the middle of the street. Why a wall, right? And then they kept going behind the wall, and they found the mikveh. And the reason, obviously, they presume the reason for the mikveh is because as people went to the temple, there were mikvahs outside Jerusalem, but if you went to the temple and you hadn't gone to mikveh, doesn't matter, man or woman, you had to go to mikveh because you had to be pure before you went into the Beit HaMikdash, into the temple, right? Obviously, if you go to mikveh, it has to be private, so they built this wall. That makes sense why there's a wall. Anyway, then he showed us an amazing thing. Towards the end, there was like, they found things like coins and stuff from that era, which is like, again, from over 2,000 years ago, the time of the temple. Then they found a credible thing. So again, let me just give you a Mishnah. The Mishnah in the Talmud talks about being a kosher witness and what it takes to be a kosher witness. One of the things it talks about is someone gambles. And there's a dispute among the commentaries. Does that mean a one-off gambling, or does it mean constantly gambles, whatever the case is? But if someone gambles, they're not really a productive human being, and therefore they're not really kosher to be a witness. The language of the Mishnah, there were different forms of gambling, is mesachek b'kuvia, someone who plays with a kuvia. What's a kuvia? A dice. That's some sort of gambling. Or a die, I don't know how you call it in English.
Yeah.
A dice, yeah? And I looked it up afterwards because I was just fascinated to see exactly what the commentaries say. And one of the famous commentaries in the Mishnah says, Etzem, it was a dice that was made out of stone. Anyway, they have found these things. It's unbelievable. Right now, it doesn't mean that's a good thing people are doing. It's just but obviously, if the Mishnah is saying there's someone who does this, he's not fit to be a witness, that means there were people doing this, right? That's why they had to be addressed. Obviously, you don't make up things about that aren't relevant. But
evidence.
Yeah. So if you want to come over to me after, I'll show you a picture. It is exactly like a dice. It's got the same numbers, the 6 to 1. Position very similar. The only thing is it's carved a bit differently, but it's a piece of stone. It's unbelievable, right?
Not big.
Similar to the dice that we have. It was exactly similar. It's very, very similar. So it goes back so, right? But it's exactly what the Mishnah was saying. Masachah b'kuvia. Anyway, many things like that. Then they found the Shiloach River, which was at Sukkos. They would draw water. Why am I saying all this? Because as we keep digging and as we keep living there, we actually discover, besides the biblical proof and the psukim and everything, right? And the Tanakh, that it's so clear that the land was promised to us, that more and more we're living the connection, the ancient connection to the land. I mean, you go near David, there are things there that were dated back to the time of Avraham Avinu, which is close to 4,000 years ago, right? It's the stones that are that age. I mean, it's crazy, right? So I think that's also what's contributing to the extreme deep sense of purpose there, right? That this is a land, this is ours from Avraham Avinu's times, and it's time, I mean, this is something we've got to. You know, Hebron was the same thing. I mean, there's stuff there that's unbelievable. The guy who took us there, like, his name is Simcha, and it's very befitting because, like, this guy is like, couldn't keep up with him. He's like crazy. And he's been living in Hebron for 30 years. Not Kiryat Arba, Hebron, which is not safe, right? But they doing it. Like, it's unbelievable, right? So that's the, yeah.
Sorry, I don't know if any of you listen to any of Elon Levy's interviews. I listen to his podcast regularly. I just listened to one recently by a guy called Duran. I don't know if it was that same Duran you mentioned, but he works in this space of antiquities, and it was absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, it's really amazing. Yeah.
What's been discovered, but I think the road he mentioned.
Could be. Yeah, I mean, that thing is, I mean, they have ruins of King David's palace. I mean, can you read it?
Yeah.
Right? We all say Tehillim, when someone's not well, we say Psalms, that's where Psalms are written. Right? I mean, it's like unbelievable, right? Okay, so let's go back to the discussion. So, purpose. Anyway. Then an interesting thing in the interview, this guy, Bonnesteel, I think his name is, asks Viktor Frankl a question. And the question is about maybe meaning is, the will for meaning is going down because much of the traditional institutions are declining. So for example, he says church, which we'll translate into shul, and family values, right? And they seem to be diminishing. So Frankl responds that, yeah, you're right, 100%. And he says it's something that he's called the existential vacuum, and it's contributed to what he calls the feeling of meaning, the feeling of meaninglessness, right? And he says an interesting thing, which he makes in other places as well, a very interesting point Viktor Frankl highlights, and that is, because this comes up in an interview also on the YouTube that I saw, that he says a person is not, he makes a huge distinction, very in line with Jewish thought, of course, between a human and an animal. Right. Only a human has a desire to live for meaning, and only a human can make choices. And only a human, he makes the distinction between being guided and forced by what you want, rather than being guided by what you should. Right? And this is where it happens. So when you move away from traditional values, like family values and religious values, right? So what happens is, he says, first, in contrast to an animal, man is not told by drives and instincts what he simply must do. In contrast to man in former times, today he is no longer told by the traditions and traditionality, right? But he's by the values of what he should do. So in other words, a human being really needs to be guided by a system of what he should do, which is giving us meaning and purpose. And what happens is, you don't have those traditions and you don't have those institutions, and you don't have those structures of things telling us what is moral and meaningful to do, so we revert back to doing what we think we must do. In other words, those instincts, those temptations, those indulgences and things that we think we must do because that's what we have an urge to do, and we don't realize that we have choice to control them and to make choices that we don't have to follow them, but we can follow other things that are being told to us about what we should do. That's what happens. So he agrees that that is a big problem, that when those traditional values are lost, meaninglessness comes in at much greater speed because we revert back to living by our instincts of what we think we have to do, right? So then, of course, he asks him a question a bit later in the interview. He says, well, if that's the case, and I want to bring it up because it's important to understand what Viktor Frankl says, right? So he says, if that's the way, can one find meaning in life without faith in God? That's the question he asks Viktor Frankl. To which he answers, he says, meaning can be found by every single person. He said, I would concede personally that it is easier to find meaning in life if you are a religious person, because obviously religious and meaning goes together, right? So, I mean, religion is about meaning. However, he says, I would have to add to push forward immediately. He said, it's easy to find meaning, but it's on the other hand, I would have to add to push forward immediately by adding that you cannot command and you cannot order anyone to believe. So Viktor Frankl actually believes, and on some level this is correct, of course, that meaning is not necessarily religion. There are other ways to find meaning, although later in other places he does concede, or he does say, that it's easier and it's stronger. And we'll see later, I think, in one of the forms of meaning that he talks about, I think you need religion for that. But nevertheless, he says meaning has many, many meanings, which we're gonna explore in a second. But before we do that, I want to just clarify and break this down, because it's interesting to have a look at his things which he says you can use to find meaning and see what commonality or what common themes they might actually have with religion, which is very fascinating. So again, he makes the point in an interview, he says, in a YouTube interview, he says that the whole concept of logotherapy is that a person is not dominated by the will for pleasure and power, but a will for meaning, right? To find, again, very important, to find and discover and find meaning, right? Now, what does this mean? So we know that we've talked about this before, but a very, very fundamental distinction between, let's say, pleasure or power and meaning is this, right? Pleasure and power have to do with me, I. That's what I want, right? So I become the starting point. And then I bring in everything that is going to, well, I live for everything that is going to give me pleasure or going to give me power, right? But the starting point is me, my ego, my egocentricity. Yeah? In other words, like we've talked about before, it's a life that is outside in. In other words, I'm bringing everything into my world because my world is the starting point. So if my world is the starting point, how am I going to feed my world? Pleasure, power, those kind of things, temptation and so on. Meaning, actually, and this is, I think, the common theme about anything that will give you some sense of meaning. Meaning means that we move away from the I. He doesn't say this. This is my interpretation, right? Which I think was happening. In other words, you're connecting to something else. You're moving towards something else, something different to you, something higher than you. And you're discovering beauty, or you're discovering meaning, or you're discovering purpose in something out of you. Yeah, does that make sense? That's why I said last week that for meaning you need sacrifice. Because whenever you live for meaning on any level, it means you're going away from the I. Anytime you go away from the I, it's hard. Because we're born with an ego. Our default position, at least on a conscious level, not on an intrinsic level, because on an intrinsic level we have a soul, but on a conscious, day-to-day, functional, operational level, we live for I. That's the way God designed us, because he wanted us to work on it, right? And therefore he created us with a default design, particularly seen in children, and most of us don't grow out of it properly, that they're completely self-centered and that's what their world is. That's the whole world that surrounds them. They don't have a sense of meaning at all. As we grow older and the soul sets in, we can discover the concept of meaning, but our default, conscious default, still remains the world of I, and moving away from I, for most people, is actually very difficult. But that's what we've got to do. That's what brings us ultimate happiness and contentment and fulfillment, but it's effort and sometimes sacrifice, right? Now, yeah, does that make sense? Now, in Judaism, of course, moving away from I and connecting to something else, ultimately, the deepest level of that and the deepest experience of that is connecting to God, because God is infinite, and the greatest meaning and the greatest happiness and the greatest ideal that a person can live for is to move away from the finiteness of the human being and connect to the infinity of God. And for that, he gave us a system, and he gave us a formula, and he gave us a moral compass, and he gave us mitzvot, and he gave us morality and values and things like that, which we'll talk about a bit more later, maybe next week. But the Torah generally is about finding meaning and purpose with everything and every experience, but it's about ultimately taking the human world and making it a godly world, right? But Frankl talks about different types of meaning, but you'll see as we go through them that the different types of meaning still means you go away from self. This is what I was coming up with when I was reading all of this. I think that point doesn't go away. That point to move away from self is kind of in all three levels of meaning that he talks about. So let's try and go through some of them. Okay. Now, before I do that, so I want to just mention a point that he makes. Both in the interview in the book and both in the YouTube interview I was watching. He's asked about this concept of self-actualization. Right? You know what self-actualization is? Very common today. A big thing, right? Sorry? Of course it's both mindsets. But he laughs at it. He laughs at it, right? So self-actualization today, just so you know, if you don't know, it's one of the latest theories, you know, in the world of modern psychology. Very modern psychology. That, you know, really developing yourself, discovering what your self is, your truth, your talents, your this, your experience, everything about your, basically, right? I, in other words, all the I thing, right? That's of course, Viktor Frankl laughs at it. And the way he laughs at it is this. He does something similar to what Ben Shachar does with regard to happiness. Remember that we had that series, and he said, pursuing happiness will never bring you happiness. And we explained when we talked about that, because it's very simple. When you pursue happiness, you're pursuing what you want. So you haven't moved away from I. When you're stuck in your I, you're never happy. This is the crazy thing about the human experience. If we all realize that, it will be a different world. Right? So if we move away, if we never move away from I, we never achieve happiness. Because we are stuck in our own pleasures, and we know that the basic need, as Frankl says, anyway, that's the problem here with address, because the address is 337 and the address is... Okay, so let's go back into this. So the basic need of human being is meaning. For meaning, you have to move away from I. Happiness, you have to move away from I. And we tend to get stuck in the I, and that never brings happiness. So Tal Ben Shachar says, you don't remember that you don't pursue happiness, you pursue things that bring happiness, which are more meaningful things. He says the same thing. He says, self-actualization is a great thing, but it's stupid. He says, when you live a life of meaning, self-actualization will come out anyway, because you will discover, you will automatically, if you do things that are meaningful, the self will flourish, right? If you pursue self-actualization, then you're just busy with yourself. If you're just busy with yourself, you won't find happiness, and you won't find contentment, and you won't even find self-actualization, because you're just busy with your ego. True self-actualization goes to the core of the human being, goes to the core and essence of who we are, which is the need, the will, and the need, and the willingness to discover meaning, and that will automatically bring out who we are. All right, so it's about moving away from self. I'll just read you one paragraph where he answers one of the questions about this. It says like this. He says, you see, there's also empirical evidence to the effect that teenagers are too much concerned with self-interpretation and self-actualization. The problem is, he was talking about when this was starting in teenagers. Those teenagers are now on our ass, I think. And it's teenagers and us and the whole world. So it's a problem. Both, of course, are detrimental, right? They obviate what I call self-transcendence. You should and may actualize yourself, but you can actualize yourself only to the extent to which you turn outward, meaning you've got to move away from yourself. And Abraham Maslow, the man who more than anyone else propagated and promulgated the concept of self-actualization. Listen to this. In his latest works before he died, was conceding and agreeing with my criticism that self-actualization can never be aimed at as a target. If you aim at it, you are missing it. Beautiful. If you aim at it, if you're looking for it, you're missing it. The same is true with happiness, with pleasure, and so forth. Very much like Tal Ben Shachar says. Okay. So what are the three levels of meaning? So the way he puts it is as follows. He says there are three values. Creative values, experiential values, and attitudinal values. Okay. The first is creative values, which means the first way to find meaning in life on a very, very basic level is to do something that creative. In other words, work, but do something that is purposeful, right? It's through work, through creating a work or doing a deed. Obviously something that is important, but right? Which means, in other words, creating something new, right? Or finding purpose in what you're doing. Remember Tal Ben Shachar also spoke about like the janitors in the hospital. The one who was just doing it because he needed a job and hated it. The other one who felt that he was contributing to society because he's helping the hospital function. Without the janitors, the doctors couldn't do their job, right? Which is true. So the concept of just doing something which you see has a purpose. Engage in something that you see has a purpose. Other, which is to the exclusion of just doing things that bring you pleasure, right? That's completely different. Again, on a very low level, but it's still the idea of go beyond yourself a little bit. Like, go beyond what you find pleasurable and do something that society, humankind, the world has benefit from. Help the world. Do something that's beneficial, right? Which he calls it creative values because it often has to do with creativity. Do something which hasn't been done. Do something which you can contribute with, right? That's the first one. Incidentally, by the way, going back to Israel, which has such a society of meaning, they're also one of the most creative societies on the planet. Right? Startups and creative stuff. It's like a very big. I mean, last week I talked about the paradox, but another paradox that's in Israel is that their systems are completely archaic, and their creativity is phenomenal. Like they have the best technology in the world, but if you go to a bank to try and open it, it's like ridiculous, right? Like they're just in the dark ages because they're just not organized. They're running it still like they started the state. Like in Yiddish we say like a chassidish malava malka. Like, but a bunch of Jews that got together on the end of Shabbat had a malava malka. That was what it was. It was a bunch of guys from the old country got together and let's make a country. And they're still on some levels running like that. But they're the most creative people, which is amazing. Anyways, okay. The second level of meaning, he says, is experiential. What does that mean? To experience something out of you. Now, this can be done in many ways. I'll tell you one he brings in Man's Search for Meaning, how this can sometimes just help a person lift, even though it's not really that important even. But nevertheless, it means just being open to experiencing something out of you. So he says that there's a story there in the concentration camp how one day, him and the other people that were there, they went to witness and went to look at a sunset, a beautiful, beautiful sunset. They could see the sunset from where they were. Obviously, the contrast to the surroundings they were in was phenomenal, but they stopped for a moment. They were able to sort of exit where they were and just marvel at the sunset and be absorbed in the beauty of the sunset, right? So he says even that is a concept of meaning, because what you're doing is you're allowing yourself to experience something outside of you, which fits into what he was saying before about moving forward. Now, it's not a huge thing, but you learn something, you see something, you experience something out of you. But in the other book that I'm reading now, in this interview, and this is what he says many times, what this translates in terms of experience something, is to experience someone else. And he goes into the concept of the depth of relationship. One of the ideas of meaning is, which again, like I explained, is translated into moving forward, moving out of yourself, is to experience someone in his very uniqueness. In other words, learning from the difference of someone else. We've talked about this a lot, but he puts it into the context of finding meaning, right? I'll read you this paragraph because it's really written very beautifully. He He says this means loving. But he says love, he defines what love is, right? Love is lashon sexual. On the contrary, human sexuality is more than just sex. Precisely to the extent to which it serves as a bodily incarnation. I may say a mode of expression, the physical mode of expressions of one's love, of a personal togetherness. This is the point I want to bring out. Getting hold of another person in his very uniqueness and seizing the uniqueness of another person is equivalent to the very definition of love. Right? So not the love, physical love or romantic love. That's pleasure, which is not a bad thing, but it has to be in the context of true love or true relationship. And we've talked about this a lot where the Torah actually says in the very beginning of Genesis that a person cannot be alone. And it's not just a comment that you can't be alone because it's lonely and it's hard and it's painful, but it's really about the concept that the essence of the human being is relationships. Why? Because as we talked about before, if Judaism holds that the ultimate life of meaning is religion, is connecting to God, it's the person connecting to an infinite God through the moral compass and the formula that he's given us, right? That requires, it's not just about doing mitzvot, just about doing the things which are important, because that's the mechanism of how we connect, but it's more of an attitude, right? It's a feeling of going beyond myself. And in the Torah, we find a fascinating thing. That for the first, I'm sure I've mentioned this before, but for the first book of the Chumash, basically, right? Five books of Moses. For the first book, we don't learn much about the relationship between Israel and God. The Torah only happens 2,000 years later, after the world is created, right? Why? What do we read about? We read about people and we read about relationships. Marriages, Avram got married, Yitzchak, Yaakov, his relationship with his father-in-law, relationship with his wives. We read about Yosef and his brothers. Good ones, bad ones, whatever the case is, but we read a lot about relationships. Why? Because I've told you this before, there's a Talmudic passage which has a fascinating thing. It says the following. It says that God can tolerate every human being and coexist with any human being except for the arrogant, which is very harsh. You can be you could have done something absolutely terrible and yet God says, I'm willing to coexist with you. I'm willing to live with you. I'm willing to reconnect with you, but only if you're not arrogant. Why? Why is arrogance the most evil thing? So it's not the most evil thing, but it's the blockage to any connection. In other words, God says, I have compassion. I can reconnect. I can tolerate. I can welcome in any person, the most impure and evil person, as long as you let me in. If you don't let me in, then I can't. It's up to you. In other words, you have to be willing to go beyond yourself. You have to be willing to take responsibility for yourself. You have to be willing to forego your ego and admit and acknowledge what you've done, whatever the case is. But if you're arrogant, I can't let you in. So therefore, the Torah tells us an important lesson. That before I can introduce myself to the Jewish people, before we can create the marriage between God and the Jewish people, I need the world to learn a little bit about relationships. If you can't have a relationship with someone else, who's a peer, but different, who's finite like you, just different, has same functioning as you, just different perspectives. If you can't do that, then you can't have a relationship with God either. It's very simple, right? And that's why we have this very interesting phrase in the Talmud. Sometimes misunderstood a bit, but and used to be thrown at us by our teachers when we were in school all the time, right? It says, Derech Eretz Kodmo LaTorah. Respect for someone else precedes the Torah. What that means is it's an historic statement, actually, that relationships came before the Torah in a way. Why does it happen? Why? Because that's the point. If you want to engage in the Torah, if you want to engage in true meaning, in true connection with God, you have to be able to respect someone else. If you can't, you're not really connected with God either. Because that's the ultimate going beyond yourself. The ultimate going beyond yourself is to become godly, is to go to connect to something completely, infinitely greater than yourself, not just another person. But if you can't connect with another person, you can't connect to God. Now, going back to what Viktor Frankl says, that's why one of the ways of meaning is relationships, but he defines not relationships that we engage in to enhance the self. Obviously, every relationship enhances the self, but again, same idea. But if you enter into a relationship just because you find it pleasurable or you want it to work for you, then it won't work for you, ultimately, because it's about you. But if you go into a relationship and have true love, which, as we've talked about before, means rub together with respect and valuing the individuality of the other person and the difference of the other person and the and the aspects of the other person that you can learn from and absorb and engage with, you're growing way beyond yourself. That's another very, that's a much deeper expression of meaning. Because you're going beyond yourself. Every time you go beyond yourself and you're learning something different, you're growing, that's already a meaningful experience. It's beyond the ego. It's inside out, going outward, rather than bringing everything into your pleasure. So that's why I said that's the second level of meaning. Then he says, the third one is what he calls attitudinal. This is a very fascinating one. He says, if need be, when you basically, it's the concept of finding meaning in suffering or in challenge, right? And this is a big thing that Viktor Frankl talks about. He says, you may even find the deepest possible, the highest conceivable meaning, because you then have an opportunity to bear witness to the human potential as it's at its best. The most human of all human capacities, which is to turn a tragedy into a personal triumph, to turn your predicament into an achievement on a human level. That's the greatest meaning. And before we get to like a religious practice and things like that, right? Major believing is to have the strength to take suffering and to take challenge and turn it into meaning. Now, he says, so life is potentially meaningful under any condition. And of course, this became so strong after his experiences in the Holocaust, where he was able to, he had that theory, as we mentioned last week, before the Holocaust, but he cemented it, and he said he experienced it during the Holocaust, right? Now, 2 points. First of all, I think this is one, it can be done by anyone, I guess. Any human being has this capacity, but I feel, and I experienced this last week as well so strongly, that it's really made properly possible with a Jewish idea, which is faith. It's hard to do without emunah, right? You can, people have done it, but without emunah, it's very, very difficult to find meaning and to turn challenge into opportunity and to find greatness in suffering, right? I think only when you have the foundation of emunah, we understand that everything is God's plan, whether we understand it or not, whether we like it or not, and that God is always with us and He's got a bigger thing. Then you're much more motivated to see, well, then what do I do with this, right? And I find the why, not the why is it happening, but the why to live. In other words, the how. What do I do now? How do I channel this? How do I take this pain and channel it into the concept of purpose and meaning, right? So that's the first point, which I think is very important. The second is a point that he makes like this. He says, because he asks him, like, it almost sounds like suffering is a good thing. So he makes the point, which is a very Jewish idea also. He said, we're not talking about choosing suffering. That is not what we're supposed to do, right? He says, but only suffering if need be. If need be, he says. To endure suffering which is unnecessary, this doesn't yield any meaning. If you can change your situation, you will have to. If an illness can be treated with surgery, you have to undergo and perform that surgery. Right? But he says the human being is limited, and ultimately life comes to an end, and even death is a part of suffering, he says. And it happens, there's some form of suffering that happens to every single person, on a high level, on a low level, and that's what we have to learn, the third level of meaning, to find meaning even in that suffering, right? And then he goes through an interesting little anecdote, and he says the following. He says, I'm going to read to you. He says, so there is certainly no one who is spared unchangeable situations, right? It could be perhaps for a couple of months, unemployment, and still life retains a meaning. In the 30s, at the time of the worldwide economic crisis, I dealt extensively with youngsters caught up in unemployment situations, and I found out that unemployment itself is not what was weighing heavily on their souls, right? Now, it's hard to be unemployed, obviously, but it wasn't the problem. But it was the mistake that they had fallen prey to. In other words, they were victims, right? Victimhood is the opposite of meaning. Like, life is dealing me a hard blow. It's hard for me. I'm suffering, that kind of thing. The mistake that having no job, having no meaning, means being useless. And the moment I had these youngsters turn to some organizations, and he mentions the youth corps and things like that, in order to work as volunteers, for example, that a meaning to fulfill, even without getting 1 cent, and the depression was gone. Amazing, amazing story, right? The person was gone. So that's the meaning. So those are the three levels of meaning. Creativity, just doing something, being involved in something productive or creative. Experiencing something, whether it's a beautiful sunset, or most importantly, experiencing other people, relationships, true relationships, going beyond one's ego, learning from the other, valuing the other's individuality. All these things are critical in the journey towards meaning. And then the idea of finding meaning even in suffering and becoming, turning it in, channeling it into achievement rather than being a victim to its negativity, right? To its toxicity. Again, he started off by saying that it doesn't have to be religion. These three things also bring meaning. But if you think deeply about it, again, this has a very common thread with religion, and that is the concept of moving beyond self. So just finishing with a couple of important things. So we talked before about self-actualization, how that is ridiculous. And of course, we don't pursue. If it's a target, then you miss it. It will come to you if you go beyond yourself, but you find meaning, it'll come to you. Now, this idea is also a very, very Jewish idea. It also needs to be understood because it doesn't mean that each person doesn't have their own uniqueness. You know, self-actualization at the end of the day is a true thing, right? Every person has a role to play. Every person has a uniqueness about them. It's just if we're obsessed about it, then we won't find it. But so if we're obsessed with meaning, then it will come to us. And sometimes we need to think about it a little bit. So there's a famous little story that the Baal Shem Tov told. I think I told this years ago, but let me repeat it. So Baal Shem Tov, who was known to have insight into what's happening in the higher worlds, he told a story about two souls that came up to heaven after 120. And they were both very devout people, and they were very good people, and did mitzvot and learned and everything, all good. Good people in general. And they were examined. That's what he says. They were examined. They were scrutinized. And the verdict came down that they're both very good people, but they're called neshamot hata'ot. They were lost souls, meaning they each one placed their energy in things that weren't their thing, weren't their role. Why? Because there was a story that happened with them like this. One was a wagon driver, and one was a very wealthy businessman. And the wealthy businessman took the wagon driver once on a trip in order to go to a city where there was a business fair, you know, like a, I don't know, whatever you call it. And on the way, it was getting close Friday, and it was getting close to Shabbos, and they weren't going to make it to the destination. So they stopped at a city. Okay. They stopped at a city. They were both going to book into a motel, and they had their food with them, whatever, and they got ready for Shabbos. Suddenly, the wealthy guy hears screams from the distance, and he runs to help because he's a good person. And he sees that there's another wagon driver. This is the wealthy person, not the wagon driver. He sees another wagon driver whose horse has got stuck in the mud. And he can't get it out, and the horse is going to die if he doesn't get it out. And he'll lose his whole sustenance, his whole livelihood. And this wealthy guy is feeling Avat Israel. You know, you got love for a fellow Jew. You got to help when you can. He says, let me help you. The problem is this guy knows nothing about horses. He hasn't driven a horse in his life. He gets wagon drivers, right? So he starts to pull and to schlep. Nothing helps. He gets hit by the horse. He gets schmutzig from all the mud, and he comes like they say, tzahakt, you know, when it comes to the shul. Like, the wagon driver, on the other hand, he didn't hear the scream, so he went to shul. He booked into the motel, and he didn't have much to do anyway. He didn't have much with him. He had a little bit of food, but not much, and he went to shul Friday night. He went to shul early. In those days, it was very often the concept that on Friday night, there were people, poor people used to come to shul, they were traveling, or they were, you know, people didn't have where to stay or where to eat, whatever the case, and they would come to shul early, and people in the shul would invite them home for Friday night. So they come early too, because they got nothing to do, and they want to be early enough to be invited out. And the only guy in the shul is this wagon driver. So he invites them all, like 10 guys, and he invites them all to his hotel room. When everyone else came, by the time davening was finished, they were all invited, so no one else could invite them to their homes. So what happens? They go to his hotel room. He doesn't have much food, only a tiny bit to share around. So they eat the Shabbos meal, they go home early, and they're hungry. Right? So both people did a tremendous mitzvah. They wanted to help other people. But you have to know what you're good at, right? You have to know what you think. So what should have happened, of course, is The rich man should have called the wagon driver, and the wagon driver should have deferred to the rich man to invite people for Shabbos, right? So that's what's called the wandering souls, the ones that like done with, they call them fablonging souls. Yiddish is the thing called fablonging, which means to lose your way. So what does that mean? It means like this. So of course there's a concept that we each have a different role, and we each have an area of emphasis, and sometimes we have to talk about that with other people, and sometimes it takes a bit of time to discover, you know, what we're good at, what we can excel at. Okay, we all have the same common values and the same mitzvot and the same willing to help other people and so on. That's true. But how we channel that is a bit different. But what Viktor Frankl is saying, which of course, again, is in line with Jewish thought, is if you're obsessed with that, if that's your starting point, then it's just about you. If my starting point is about something higher, my starting point is not that I'm going to be a good guy or I'm going to be a good people helping me and I'm going to work out exactly what I'm best at. No. If the starting point is let me give myself over to a higher cause, then of course along the way I'm going to have to give some thought to what I'm good at, what I'm not good at, right? But what's your starting point? What's your journey? What do you want out of life? If it's about just what's good for you and pleasure and achievement and arrogance and fame and honor, then of course self-actualization is going to be your obsession and it's not going to work because it's not going to bring contentment and happiness. But if your starting point is, no, I want to just do what's right, I want to give myself over, I want to surrender to something higher than me, then of course along the way you've got to deal with what you're good at. Of course you've got to fit in and not invite people for Shabbos if you don't have food, or not try to fix wagons when you don't know how, or you don't know what you're doing, right? Because you need to be a little bit higher, you need to be a little bit clever about how you can achieve the meaning that you're looking for. Which of course is very connected to what we going to celebrate this Sunday night a week, which is Shavuot. Shavuot is a week and a few days away. Shavuot is the time we became a nation. And of course, we all know the famous phrase that when the Jews accepted the Torah, they said, Na'aseh v'nishma. We commit and then we're going to understand. So it's not just about doing and understanding. These two things represent two important ideas. Na'aseh is an expression of surrender, right? But surrenders are good enough. You have to have nishma. You have to understand and you have to think and you have to reflect. And something you have to even self-explore a little bit. But it's got to be after you say Na'aseh. The first step has to be, I'm ready. I'm ready to go beyond myself. Then God says, well, now use your brain. Don't just surrender. Think in the context of your surrender, in the context of your aspiration to find something higher than yourself and to find meaning. Part of that is using your brain, reflecting, using your emotions and so on and so forth. It all depends what the starting point is. So those are the basic ideas. Today's idea was to find out what is meaning, right? And this is the three levels of Viktor Frankl's idea, and they all come with one common theme about going beyond yourself, what he calls beautifully moving outwards. More to come. See you next week. Have a wonderful day.